Where Murder Meets Mystery contains graphic and explicit content. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey, ghoul friends, let's take a walk down the street where murder meets mystery, a podcast exploring the murderous, the mysterious, and everything that lies beyond the beyond. I'm your brother in podcasting. Probably already said that, but yeah, I'm Trevor. You know me. How's it going?
Fun riff. Unique riff. I am your sister in Christ, Grace.
Yeah, and we're recording, which is good.
Yeah, Christ.
Christ.
Big ups to Christ.
Big up to the number one.
Hey, little friends, welcome back. Episode 55.
Episode 57. Yay.
I am absolutely flummoxed that we've had 55 episodes. Flabbergasted.
Yeah, it's more than the deck of cards. As my dad would say, that's double nickels.
We are flabbergasted and finger blasted.
Whoa. Not me.
Those rhyme. Bars.
I'm your heterosexual podcast host, Trevor.
Yuck. Oh my god.
Oh god.
And I'm heterosexual except when it comes to Gal Gadot and Miranda Kerr. I think she's happy.
Especially when she sings the Imagine song when everyone was dying of COVID.
So true.
Yeah. Probably the hottest moment.
And Vanessa Hudgens. Do you remember her? Yeah, people are gonna die.
Oh, wow.
She was like, that's exactly how she said it. It was like a video on Instagram, I think. It was a live. And she was like, I just don't understand the big deal. Like, people are gonna die. But like, it was like, ugh.
Ugh. Yeah, the podcast where we talk about famous people, talk about dead people for a long time.
Literally every time. It's fine. Trevor has a lot of notes. You got a hefty case.
I do.
My case is not hefty.
That's okay. I cut down a tree, ghoul friends.
Wow. I know, we were just talking about this. Chainsaws.
Yeah, confession time.
Chainsaws are an extension of a man's member, wouldn't you say?
Of a man's psyche. I don't know. Chainsaws scratch a male itch. I would say cutting down trees and just, like, cutting the limbs apart and, like, all that stuff.
Sure.
Yeah. It just kind of scratches something deep within you. Also, watching a tree fall, pretty satisfying. But don't get it twisted. I have a sensitive side. Before we cut down the tree, I felt really sad.
Yeah.
And I patted the tree multiple times, saying thank you.
Yeah. You're like Marie Kondo, the Japanese lady that organizes drawers.
Yes, I patted the tree 3 times. I said, thank you for your service. And I said, but you do not bring me joy. And then I proceeded to just start the chainsaw.
Spark joy, motherfucker!
Yeah. I said, you didn't bring me joy while you're standing. Hopefully you'll bring me joy as I cut you into pieces.
You know, I don't like that image. That's a little disturbing. All right.
I'm talking about trees, cool friends.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything you were saying, like just watching the limbs like fall and getting the and cutting it apart with a chainsaw itches a scratch.
Yeah. What is it? What is it about dismembering living things that men love?
Oh, God. You know, women also love dismembering, which is what my case is about.
Oh, segue.
Yeah. Segue. How much does a segue?
Enough to break the ice.
So true. Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
Wait, that was funny. Was that a joke? Did I just make that joke up, or is that already a joke and you just
do what, how much is a segue?
Yeah, you said enough to break the ice. That was hilarious.
Yeah, that's how much does a polar bear weigh?
Oh.
But I just combined jokes.
Okay.
Man, it was really good if we just left it subvertedly, but now that I had to explain it, I think, oh.
Maybe I should have said anything.
You know what? You're welcome, ghoul friends.
Us always questioning. You know how, okay, ghoul friends, you know how after any social encounter, maybe this is just me and I'm projecting, after any social encounter, you're just like standing in the shower and you're like.
No, I sit in the shower.
I lay down. I take a bath with the shower on.
I lay down on my stomach and put my head in the drain and hope after every social encounter.
Just occasionally breaching like a whale.
I don't breach.
Blowing. You don't breach?
Yeah.
I don't breach, I beach.
Damn.
Bars. Bars. Okay, so listen, girlfriends. Listen. Anchorman?
I don't even know what you were going for.
Okay, in commemoration of our 55th episode, I have something a little lighter.
Wow.
In fact, lighter in the sense that both people involved come out alive, albeit semi-intact.
Oh, I see. I think this might be where the little bit of foreshadowing with the dismemberment joke earlier.
Actually, you have no idea how much foreshadowing has happened in the past 5 minutes. It's pretty hilarious.
I'm excited.
So some of you may know about the story because it's pretty famous. But I'm going to be talking about Lorena Bobbitt.
Bobbitt.
Trev?
La Lorena was a movie about I don't know. It's kind of like a either Mexican folklore or something or other. I don't know. Some sort of Hispanic folklore.
So you could have said no because you don't know, clearly.
I don't.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so Lorena Bobbitt. I'm so excited that you don't know this story because
Lorena Bobbitt.
Hilarious. Okay.
Lorena, I like the name.
Maiden name Gallo. It's spelled like Gallo. Hey, Nick. Gallo, but it's Gallo because she's from Ecuador. Immigrated to the U.S. from Ecuador and shortly after met John Wayne Bobbitt.
His name John is Wayne Bobbitt.
Yeah. Bobbitt, who was 2 years her junior. And they met in the 1980s. The two were married on June 18th, 1989. Okay?
Yeah.
Settled in Manassas?
Virginia. Manassas. Yeah.
Virginia, where the incident would later take place. Now, a little background that would later come out in court, okay? Lorena would later claim that John had sexually, physically, and emotionally abused her, that they lacked financial stability, and that John had stolen her earnings and spent the proceeds. Side note, when I did read that the first time, I thought it said earrings. I was like, that's what this shit is about? That's
just earrings.
Earrings. Had stolen her earrings. It's like, what? And spent the proceeds. I'm like, how much money is a pair of earrings going for on eBay? Used, probably. You know? $3?
Well, depends by who.
That's true. Yeah. You think it's like a...
I mean, men will pay women for socks, so right. I don't know what they're going to do for earrings.
How people buy... I had a man reach out to me on Instagram one time and asked me to send him a pair of my gym socks.
Wow.
Yeah, and I've never posted my dogs online, so I don't know how he got the inkling. I'm thinking he just, like, tries that with, like, 300...
Maybe, yeah.
And, you know. Yeah,
it's the law of averages for him.
And maybe just, like, one sticks, you know. And that's enough.
Yeah.
That's enough to get his socks off.
Get his rocks off on the socks that he just dropped off.
Bars. Okay.
God. No one has asked for my socks, but they could have them if they want them.
Okay, so Lorena... Oh, I already said that. Okay, so Lorena's claims would later be substantiated in court by multiple expert witnesses who alleged that he had mentally and physically battered her, that the abuse was escalating, and by June 23rd, 1993, Lorena was living in constant fear of him. That evening... On June 23rd, Lorena claims she came home and John raped her in their bedroom. John would later refute this, though he changed his story several times, claiming a number of things. One, that they had not had sex and Lorena was lying. Two, that they had sex, which Lorena had initiated. Three, she had tried to initiate, but John had been too tired and they had had sex, but he slept through it. Then four, that the sex had been consensual.
What the hell?
The sex had been clinical. Okay.
How tired do you have to be?
Right.
How tired do you have to be?
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Who hasn't faked being asleep? Like, you know. Everyone.
Yeah, but like to actually sleep during intercourse.
Right. To actually fall asleep. Yikes. Right.
Yeah.
Either way, we believe women on this podcast. I believe that he raped her.
Oh, and yeah. I just.
It checks out given what happens next. So apparently this is the straw that broke the camel's back. After the attack, Lorena went downstairs to get a drink of water. In the kitchen, she grabbed an 8-inch Jinsu carving knife on the counter. She returned to the bedroom where John lay asleep. Lorena pulls back the bed sheets and, using the knife, cut off John's penis in a swift motion.
No, I don't believe that.
Lorena then departed from the apartment, holding the severed penis in one hand.
No, not in a swift motion. No way.
Struggling to steer with one
hand. No way. No way, she had to carve it off.
Struggling to steer with one hand, Lorena drove for some time, then flung the penis out of the moving car onto a roadside field. After continuing on her drive, Lorena eventually stopped the car and called 911, reporting the incident and telling dispatch the approximate location of John's severed member. How are you feeling? Do you understand?
I'm okay.
This was like everything we said was foreshadowing.
I get it.
How much does a dick weigh? Lorena knows.
Lorena does know.
Yeah. She knows everything. Lorena's all-knowing.
Yeah. But honestly, I still don't think you could just sever a penis in one slice. I really don't think. Like, I have some kitchen knives. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you got to cut a tomato pretty hard in order to get it going.
I don't think your knives are sharp enough.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
You got to cut a tomato hard to get it going?
Yeah.
Get the tomato going?
To get the cutting going, you know what I'm saying? But I don't know. Maybe her knives are sharper than mine. Who knows? Yeah. I'm envisioning a hacking situation here.
Either way, he was claimedly asleep. So
my sister. I don't see how that happens. Well, this guy can sleep. Yeah. I want what he's having. Other than the severed member, I want his sleep.
Well, he's a fucking rock, man.
Yeah.
Not hard as a rock, because he has no rock.
Bars. He's no longer, he can no longer smell what the rock has been cooking.
Ew. Okay, hold on. My sister's alarm clock is going off, so I need to go wake her up. The alarm is not waking her up.
I mean, if you want to leave, that's fine. I understand. You don't have to make up some silly excuse. Girlfriends, if she wants to go, she can go.
She's free. You're free to leave at any time.
I'm sorry, but my sister's alarm clock's going off. I gotta go.
I gotta go. Coming, Mom. Oh, man. Okay. All right. Police officers.
Back to dicks,
yes. This is very serious, girlfriends. Police officers famously found John's severed penis in a grassy lot across from a 7-Eleven. Quote, John's penis was found after an exhaustive search. And after being washed with antiseptic and packed in saline ice, it was reattached at the hospital where he was treated. Impressively, after this exhaustive search, John's penis was found and actually reattached in a 9-hour surgery.
Mm. You know, that would be kind of a beautiful, portrait, and I know you're a great artist, but just, like, a really big, like, 20-inch by, like, 20-inch canvas portrait, hand-painted, and it's just a meadow, but in the focal point of the meadow is just, like, a severed penis.
Yeah. I appreciate
And, like, the sun's going down, and people are like, what's that? I'm like, oh, it's a portrait of...
Sure, yeah.
You know, a meadow, and there's a... severed penis.
Yeah. And this is a metaphor for...
Yeah. Just like a beautiful photo, and then just like the only thing wrong with it is there's just a dick in a field.
Dick in a field. Yeah. No, I appreciate your vision. And I would love to help that come to fruition. I really
would. It's the first thing you see when you walk into someone's house. Like they have a foyer, and you just like...
Foyer.
Well, with that painting, it is a foyer. It's what makes it from a foyer to a foyer.
Mm.
It's so French, so European.
I saw this this interview on Ellen with, I think it was Julia Roberts, maybe. Maybe someone else. Anyway, she was talking about how her daughter they were in, she was talking about her house and like how her daughter plays piano. And she's like, mm-hmm. yeah, she likes to play in the piano room. And Ellen was like, oh, the piano room. She goes, yeah, I thought it would be less pretentious than a parlor. And Ellen was like, so you went with piano?
Yeah, so you went with a very specific room for the piano?
For this specific task, yeah.
I think parlor makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So back to Lorena. She was arrested that night, and she told police in their various sexual encounters. That sounds like she had sex with the police. Hold on. Let me reword that.
I think I know what you mean. There's
Lorena arrested that night. What? Am I having a stroke? Lorena was arrested that night, and she told police that in her and John's various sexual
encounters. I think we understand it, that she didn't have multiple encounters with the police that night.
Police, yeah. Through the course of their marriage, John had been not only abusive, but also a selfish lover, always having an orgasm himself, but never waiting for Lorena to have one.
Wow.
Yeah. So he deserved what he got, I think. The Prince William County Assistant Commonwealth's Attorney. That's a title. I wonder what fits on his business card.
It doesn't.
It doesn't.
He has two.
He has an extended business card. He has a third leg in his pants.
He got the extendo clip on the business card.
Extendo clip.
He whips it out and it just like unfolds into eight business cards.
Like a scroll. Yeah. He is the Prince William's the Prince William County Assistants. It's very funny. And Commonwealth. I don't know. Okay, so he would later prosecute Lorena and use this recorded conversation with police as evidence against her. During the trial, Lorena announced her allegations of abuse, also claiming that John had been unfaithful to her multiple times during their relationship, had rubbed these infidelities in her face. That was a poor choice.
Rub, yeah.
Rub, yeah. Had rubbed one
out. I'm interested to see how this goes, because like, is she gonna get off scot free? Like, you can cut someone's penis off if you just claim all these things.
Yeah, we'll see. Had rubbed these infidelities in her face, and had at one point forced Lorena to have an abortion. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what she claimed. Okay. Lorena's defense team claimed that John's continuous abuse eventually caused Lorena to snap, which kind of like callback. Our last episode where we talked about psychic breaks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She had a folia peen. I don't know.
The folia weenair.
The weenair caused psychosis in the
in one swift motion.
I don't know. That kind of sounds like Caribbean.
In one swift motion.
Yeah.
It did. Yeah, a little bit Jamaican. Okay, so they also cite Lorena's diagnoses with clinical depression and potential PTSD from the abuse as potential causes for her attacking John. Both the prosecution and the defense conceded that John had demonstrated a history of abuse towards Lorena. So no one's questioning that he was abusive.
Right. Okay.
But they disagreed on Lorena's state of mind when cutting off her husband's penis. While the prosecution argued a planned attack and malicious intent, the defense argued a bout of temporary insanity constituting an irresistible impulse to cut off her husband's member.
Yeah, I mean, okay. Intrusive thoughts. Impulsive.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Intrusive thoughts are sober thoughts. I've always said that.
Yeah. The difference is that having an intrusive thought and then acting upon the intrusive thought.
Correct. Right.
That's what separates the member from the body. And that's whether or not you decide to, I'm going to cut his dick off. And so, then it's like, no, I'm actually going to cut his dick off. That's the difference.
I agree. Okay. So, one expert for the defense testified that John had allegedly threatened Lorena when she broached the topic of divorce, stating that, quote, I will find you whether we're divorced or separated, and wherever I find you, I'll have sex with you whenever I want to. Not a good look, John.
Yeah, that's a weird thing to say.
That's fucked.
No matter how you shake that, it's a weird thing to say.
Yeah, no, not just, yeah, it's fucked.
Very rapey.
So, very rapey, yeah. John Wayne Bobbitt was acquitted of marital sexual assault, but went on to accumulate a long record of serious abuse allegations by other women and several criminal convictions. So, not a good guy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In the case against Lorena Bobbitt, the jury deliberated for 7 hours, eventually finding Lorena not guilty due to insanity, causing, to use the defense's words, an irresistible impulse to cut off her husband's penis. Because of the defense, the state could not hold Lorena liable, though they ordered her to be admitted to Central State Hospital in Petersburg, where she would undergo a 45-day evaluation period, and the hospital eventually released her.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And finally came to a close in 1995 when, after 6 years of marriage, John and Lorena would finalize their divorce. So they, in the end, both alive, neither convicted. So happy. Yeah. Ending. You know?
Yeah. Finally a happy ending.
Speaking of happy endings, I'm going to get there. Lorena Bobbitt would go on to establish a charitable foundation that helped domestic abuse victims and their children, called the Lorena Gayo Foundation, speaking at universities and events, but otherwise living a rather quiet, unassuming life in Gainesville, Florida, while John's life took a dramatic turn in the opposite direction. Following the reattachment of his dick, John Bobbitt would go on to star in not one, but two pornographic films.
Oh.
He met porn actor and director Ron Jeremy at the Playboy Mansion, where John was attending a Wet and Wild party.
Wait, do they, what's his stage name? Like, oh, the I'm Scar?
Gonna I'm going to get there.
Oh, yeah, go.
Ron proposed that John do a small cameo with lines in a pornographic film, but John said, nah, I want a starring role. He would later tell Vanity Fair that, quote, a porno seemed like the best way to show my penis worked, unquote. And that assured, and then he assured the media.
Oh, show that my penis worked.
Yes. And he assured the media in 2018 that his penis was, quote, back to normal.
Good.
The porno in question, John Wayne Bobbitt Uncut.
Uncut.
Included a brief cameo by Lemmy from the band Motorhead. Also wrote a song for the film's soundtrack titled Under the Knife.
Oh my God.
I fucking love it so much. A reporter for Entertainment Weekly would later say of the film, quote, even by conventional porn standards, it's a pretty bad movie.
Wow.
A quote from a 1994 article in the Phoenix News-Times. Even before shooting began, the Bobbitt porno flick received more mainstream attention than any adult film in recent memory. Non-hardcore clips from the epic have even appeared on national television, including CNN.
Oh, wow.
That article.
They took it. Snippets of it. No.
Don't
what
say
the snippets. Hell?
That article, by the way, is called, quote, New Porn Docudrama Explores John Wayne Bobbitt's Severance Package, which is fucking hilarious.
Oh, Severance Package. Wow. But also, like, docuseries? Porn docuseries? Mm-hmm. What? Mm-hmm. No.
This would not be John Bobbitt's only starring role. He also starred in another porno entitled Frankenpenis, not to be confused
Frankenpenis. With the
children's film Frankenweenie.
Wow. The adult version of Frankenweenie.
Fun fact, Jordan Peele, producer of Get Out and Us, would later produce a docuseries with Amazon called Lorena, chronicling the night that Lorena Bobbitt did the unthinkable, lop off her sleeping husband's penis.
Wow.
Lopping is a verb. That's quite the verb. Lorena had only been 24 at the time of the incident, and John was 22. Isn't that wild? They were young.
It is wild. And it's wild that everything kind of, like, worked out, sort of. And I'm glad that he got divorced, but also, like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I know what I'm getting you for your birthday.
So true. Yeah.
A signed CD or a disc, DVD.
Yeah. I will get you a painting.
Of Frankenpenis.
A painting of a meadow. A landscape, if you will. With a nice manscape in the foreground.
A landscape with a small manscape.
Yeah, bars. At the end of the day, it's easy to feel sorry for John Bobbitt, but cool friends, don't be tempted. Because John Bobbitt is just as much of a knucklehead as any other asshole covered on this podcast, and his abuse against Lorena Bobbitt should not be overlooked despite the sensationalization of this case. All this is to say that Lorena Bobbitt is a fucking queen and has since become a hero among survivors of domestic abuse. Despite this, the story would become a national punchline, spoofed on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno and Saturday Night Live, and inspired a slew of movies, documentaries, and porn docuseries. To end, I thought I'd include some quotes from my father, who uttered these when I told him I would be covering the case today.
Oh, wow.
Quote, "Ah, yes, John Bobbitt. He went on to be a successful concert pianist."
A concert pianist? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not a pianist. I get it.
Quote, "Her porno should be called Lorena Bobbitt, How to Get Ahead."
Wow. These are top tier dad jokes.
Oh, yeah. Quote, "You know, I really feel like she got the shaft on that one."
Yeah. She really did.
Finally, a joke he found online. Quote, "While leaving the scene of her infamous revenge, Lorena discovers that she is still gripping the disconnected member of that cheating bastard. She flings it out the car window into oncoming traffic. Unfortunately, it slaps against the windshield of a mom and young daughter. 'Mom, what was that?' the daughter asked. The mom, trying to protect her innocence, says that it was just a bug, honey." "A bug?" "Yes, dear, a bug." "Wow," the little girl says. "Sure had a big dick."
Wow.
A statement, by the way, I'm calling into question, given the photos provided by an expert witness. Trevor, please examine this photo on the drive.
Oh, no. Is it the weenie?
Yep.
I want to see the penis. Ouch.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to say this again. It looks more like a thumb, doesn't it?
Yeah, okay. Well, he's definitely a grower, not a shower, but also, like, ow.
Yeah, so I do find it hysterical, by the way, that this guy went through probably a decade of schooling just to get on the stand and hold up an enlarged photo of a severed penis in vivid.
I like his the way he does it too. It's kind of like if that was your penis, that's what you'd look like when you took it out.
Right.
You'd just be like, "Here it is."
He's very matter of fact.
He's like
very serious.
Here it is. Mm-hmm. I don't like the way it looks though. It's one of those things that, like, yeah, as a man, it just kind of hurts to look at.
Yeah, well, they did John pretty dirty.
Yeah.
Showing his penis on national television.
Yeah.
Then he went on to claim it, reclaim it as his own.
Yeah, he said, "You know what? I'll show you that it still works." And
right.
I haven't seen it, but I bet he tried.
And he's back to normal, ladies and gents.
Yeah. I will say, all the things you said about how we're making light of this, it is. I'll say, ghoul friends, lady ghoul friends, any ghoul friends, please let it be the last thing you do is cut a dick off. There are plenty of options to figure it out before then.
I don't know.
Which I understand domestic violence is not easy or simple, but like, I don't know. It might not work out for you as well as it did for her. That's all I'm saying.
I'm team Lorena. She's fucking iconic. That's all I have to say.
Yeah. But just, like, don't start, like, these copycat dick cuttings, because it's probably not going to work out as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's it.
That's it. Wow. That's great. I liked it. That was a good break from the normal murders.
A little palate cleanser for you.
Yeah. I liked it.
My coffee's turning into iced coffee because the fan's on.
Well, that's good.
Yes. Yeah.
Well,
speaking of segue, how much is a segue?
Speaking of segue, enough to move on to the next case mystery.
I'm so all right.
So I got a big one. This was, I think, unlike either John, Molly asked me to do this, or some other people did. I can't remember, but it was also something that I've heard about and was deeply interested in. You're cracking up over there. You all right?
So, because you said I got a big one, and I said unlike John.
Right. John has a, you know, it's normal size, I guess.
Modest, family-sized home. Modest 2-bedroom, 1-bath.
Exactly.
I got a 2-bedroom, 1-bath.
Yeah, it doesn't have a piano room, but it'll.
Despite this, he became a concert pianist.
Exactly.
Yeah, I've always thought the word pianist was far too close to penis.
Yeah, you have to really enunciate the pian in it, and not just
the t.
Oof.
Oof. Okay, let's hear it.
So, all right. So
it, you said.
Yeah, and we're gonna do a little bit of a soft oven open here. So, on Thanksgiving Eve, November 24th, 1971, a man carrying a black attaché case or briefcase was approached the flight counter of Northwest Orient Airlines at Portland International Airport. Using cash, the man bought a one-way ticket on flight 305, a 30-minute trip north to SeaTac, which is Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. Mm-hmm. And on his ticket, the man listed his name as Dan Cooper.
Okay.
That's right, girlfriends. We're doing D.B. Cooper and how he, you know, jumped out of an airplane and disappeared.
Oh, my God.
So, D.B. Cooper. Eyewitnesses described Cooper as a white male in his mid-40s with dark hair and brown eyes, wearing a black or brown business suit, a white shirt and a thin black tie, a black raincoat, and brown shoes. Carrying a briefcase and a brown paper bag, Cooper boarded Flight 305, a Boeing 727, and then Cooper took his seat in 18E in the last row of the plane and ordered a drink, bourbon and 7-Up.
Gross. Wait, a business suit? As opposed to a, what? A birthday suit?
Well, I don't claim to know a lot about suits, but business suit, I imagine it back then probably meant something.
Okay.
But, you know, very, very dark gentleman. Yeah. Well, and his whole outfit is kind of dark. So, if you want, there's images on the drive.
Okay.
So, you know, brown eyes, brown hair, kind of unsuspecting looking.
Yeah, he just looks like a dude. His eyes are a little far apart. And he does have a unibrow.
Yeah, and this is just a sketch, so this isn't exactly what he looks like. This is just, you know, the sketch they put together, because they didn't necessarily get a photo of him, and they didn't really know what he looks like. But what did you say?
I said, do we know what he looks like?
No, because no, like, they didn't have, no one took a photo, there weren't any camera footage or anything, because it's the 70s.
Driver's license or something? Do you have photos on driver's licenses?
I guess not, because, I mean, he approached the airplane counter or the ticket counter at the airport and paid with cash. Okay. So, back then, maybe you didn't need a driver's license to fly.
Yeah.
As long as you had some cold, hard cash, you could get on a plane.
Right. Okay.
With a crew of 6 and 37 passengers aboard Flight 305, they left Portland on schedule at 2:50 PST. So 2:50 p.m. Mm-hmm. Shortly after takeoff, Cooper handed a note to the flight attendant, Florence Schaffner, sitting in the jump seat directly behind Cooper. Because remember, he's in the back of the plane. So he's back there with the flight attendant. So he passed her a note. She assumed the note was a lonely businessman's phone number, and Schaffner dropped the note into her unopened purse. She dropped the note unopened, so she didn't even open the note to even care what he had passed her, into her purse.
Okay.
Cooper then leaned back towards her, like, and faced her and whispered, "Miss, you better look at that note. I have a bomb."
No. Ew.
Schaffner quickly opened the note. In neat, all capital letters, printed with a felt-tip pen, Cooper had written, "Miss, I have a bomb in my briefcase, and I want you to sit by me." Schaffner returned the note to Cooper, sat down as Cooper requested, and quietly asked to see the bomb. Cooper opened his briefcase, and inside there was a severed penis that Lorena had not. Nah. I'll show you this.
A grassy field.
Yeah. It was a beautiful painting of a grassy meadow. No. Okay. So
preserve the severed member in the foreground. You know, by exactly. the way, I forgot to say that Wine and Crime, which is great true crime podcast, hilarious, by the way, they covered the Lorena Bobbitt case, and one of them was talking about how, like, her favorite part of the whole the whole case was the idea of all these forensic techs, like, diligently combing through the fields trying to find the penis. And I think that's so funny, that image.
Well, if you've ever, like, searched for something in a field, like an overgrown field, it's really difficult. Like, and the fact, yeah, like, we've lost, we would play, like, Capture the Flag and, like, Boy Scouts. And sometimes you would grab the flag and you would throw it. And it's like, well, even if it's at night, good luck. Like, there's no way. But even during the day, if you're trying to find it in the, like, the tall grass, you have to, like, comb through everything.
How do they avoid stepping on it? That's my first question. Second, how do they know that some sort of animal didn't carry it off? Because wouldn't a severed penis...
You don't. You wouldn't know. Yeah, you wouldn't know if it's gotten carried off. But also, like, how do you not step on it? Well, you look where you step.
Okay. Way to mansplain that for me.
Well, I'm just saying, if you're looking for a penis, the last thing you want to do is say, oh, found it. It's underneath my heel.
Yeah.
Let me squish it in the mud.
What if they're just like, oh, I stepped in gum. Gross.
Wait, something stuck. They get back to the car. They're like, did you guys find anything? No. But something stuck to my shoe.
Yeah, what's that smell? You guys smell that? Okay, go.
So, of course, Cooper didn't bring a penis in his briefcase. But he opened his briefcase, and Schaffner saw two rows of four red cylinders. She assumed was dynamite. Attached to the cylinders were a wire and a large cylindrical battery. So, you know, shit looks sus. So she was like, all right. Cooper closed the briefcase and told Schaffner his demands. Schaffner wrote a note with Cooper's demands, carried the note to the cockpit, and informed the flight crew of the situation.
Informed the flight crew.
Yeah. First rule about the flight crews. We don't talk about flight crew.
Okay.
Captain Scott, who was, I guess, the pilot, directed Schaffner to remain in the cockpit. So many shafts and cocks in this one. Why did you do your case? Why?
That's what I'm saying. Like, our precursor was just hilarious.
I got to get through this because, like, I'm going to be saying cockpit a lot, but you kind of set me up for failure.
I'm trying to be cool about it. Go for it.
Oh, man. I know, but... Oh, God. For the remainder of the flight... Oh, God. Let me restart. Captain Scott directed Schaffner to remain in the cockpit for the remainder of the flight and take notes of events as they unfolded. Scott then contacted Northwest Flight Operations in Minnesota. Stop laughing at unfolded. Please, God. Now we're doing that thing where we're just fixated on anything that's remotely...
I'm good. I'm in control. I'm good.
We can, yeah. As I was gonna say, because I'm guilty of this too. So, All right. Take a deep breath and let it out. Don't think about penis. Okay.
We are professionals.
We are in our 20s. We are adults. We can do this.
Okay. We're almost in our 30s.
Almost in our 30s.
Together. Okay.
Closer to the 30s and the 20s, we can do this.
Oh, gross. Now I'm spiraling. Okay, go for it.
Okay. So, Scott contacted the Northwest Flight Operations in Minnesota and relayed the hijacker's demands. Cooper requests $200,000 in a knapsack by 5 p.m. He wants two front parachutes. Mm-hmm. Two back parachutes. He wants the money in negotiable American currency, quote, with Schaffner in the cockpit, flight attendant Tina Mucklow, which, thank God, we don't get to say Schaffner anymore.
Why has it got to be a knapsack?
We'll get to that because it's interesting. Why not So another flight attendant, Tina Mucklow, sat next to Cooper to act as, like, she took basically Schaffner's place so that Schaffner could take notes in the cockpit.
Okay.
Tina Mucklow's, so basically she was like the communicator too. Mm-hmm. So Cooper then made additional demands upon landing. That's not a word.
Yeah.
Upon landing in Seattle, the fuel trucks must meet. The fuel trucks must meet the plane, and all passengers must remain seated while Mucklow brings the money aboard. And after he had the money, he would release the passengers. The last items brought aboard would be the four parachutes. So he had a very specific order where he wanted to get everything.
Okay.
Captain William A. Scott informed Seattle Tacoma Airport air traffic control of the situation, and SeaTac, just Seattle Tacoma, air traffic control contacted local police and the FBI. The passengers were told their arrival in Seattle would be delayed because of a minor mechanical difficulty. Ooh. Donald Nyrup, the president of Northwest Orient, which is the airline, authorized payment of the ransom and ordered all employees to cooperate with the hijacker and comply with his demands. For approximately 2 hours, Flight 305 circled Puget Sound to give Seattle police and the FBI sufficient time to assemble Cooper's ransom money and parachutes and to mobilize emergency personnel. So this was supposedly a 30-minute flight that now has turned into 2 hours.
Oh.
Due to a mechanical failure.
They're not fueled for that, right?
Well, maybe they. I guess they were, but because they did land and they've survived, but they were trying to play it off to try to basically tell people that everything's okay, no one has a bomb, it's a mechanical failure, and we've got to land.
Oh, so one of his demands, if I understood you correctly, one of his demands was that they say the flight was suffering from mechanical failure, rather than.
It could have been, I'm not exactly sure if that was his demand or that was their way of not causing mass panic.
Okay.
Because I'm sure the last thing, that's probably protocol for them. The last thing they want to do is say, hey, people have hijacked the plane.
Yeah, just so you're aware.
Right.
It's like CVS.
Someone's got a bomb. Good luck sitting in your seat and staying calm. While the plane circled Seattle, Mucklow chatted with Cooper and asked why he picked Northwest Airlines to hijack. Cooper replied, "It's not because I have a grudge against your airlines. It's just because I have a grudge."
Just period.
Yeah.
You see, my girlfriend cut off my penis, and I'm really mad about it.
And it's, I chopped it up very finely and put it in this dynamite, so.
Blech. Yeah, it's shrapnel. He made an IED. The D stands for dick.
It does.
Improvised explosive dick.
Basically.
Yeah. Okay, go for it. I'm being serious.
I know. Cooper then asked where Mucklow was from, and Mucklow said she was originally from Pennsylvania, but was living in Minneapolis at the time. Minnesota was very nice country, Cooper responded. Mucklow then asked Cooper where he was from, but he became upset and refused to answer, which is
It sounds like he's foreign. Because he said knapsack, which is weird, and then he asked for negotiable American currency, which is strange, and then he said Minnesota is nice country.
Yeah. When it says Minnesota was very nice country, which maybe he just means the land. I don't know. It's 1970s. Everyone sounds foreign.
It's what?
It's the 70s. Everyone sounds foreign to us.
Or that's Russian syntax where they're very nice country, you know?
Oh, yeah, maybe. But yeah, of course he got upset when she was like, "Where are you from?" He's like, "All right, bro, I'm a hijacker." Getting a little too close here there, Mucklow. Anyway, Cooper then asked Mucklow if she smoked and offered her a cigarette. Mucklow said she had quit, but, accepted the cigarette from Cooper because,
that's how Mucklow fell off the wagon.
Right.
Yeah.
You're about to get hijacked and he's got a bomb. It's if any time's a good time to smoke, it's not around a bomb.
I'd light one up. Oh. But
anyway.
Right.
70s were built different. FBI agents used several banks in the Seattle area to assemble the ransom. The money, which was 10,000 unmarked $20 bills, most of which had serial numbers beginning with L, indicating that they were issued by the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. and was photographed on microfilm by the FBI in order so they could tell the bills apart from anywhere else.
Okay.
Cooper rejected the military issue parachutes offered by McCord Air Force Base personnel and demanded 4 civilian parachutes with manually operated ripcords.
Why?
I don't know. Seattle police obtained 2 front reserve parachutes from a local skydiving school and 2 back main parachutes from a local stunt pilot. So for some reason, he was like, I don't want none of that military crap, bro. I want
Tom Cruise's shoot. Where is
basically. It? Yeah, the local stunt pilot. At around 5:24 p.m., remember this started at 2, so it's been a couple hours. Captain right. Scott was informed that the parachutes had been delivered to the airport and notified Cooper that they soon would be landing. At 5:46 p.m., Flight 305 landed at SeaTac, and Scott asked Cooper's permission, and Cooper agreed to park the aircraft on a partially lit runway away from the main terminal. Cooper demanded only one representative of the airline could approach the plane with the parachutes and the money, and the only entrance and exit would be through the aircraft's front door via the mobile air stairs. So basically, they just kind of like made the air stairs like in order so someone could get on and off, but they didn't necessarily like fly up to the passenger. Like they weren't at a terminal, right? So the only way to get on and off the plane was like the emergency air stairs. Like, does that make sense?
Like what the presidents use?
Sort of. But they like rolled up like a
right.
Like a staircase, basically. Yeah. For like, people to exit onto the tarmac.
Private jets have those. Right. So, yeah.
Very true, very true.
Yes.
Northwest Orient's Seattle's operations manager. God, Al Lee was designated to be the courier who would approach the aircraft with the items that Cooper requested. So there was a guy, the operations manager. So big leader doing the big things. We love leading by example. To avoid the possibility that Cooper might mistake Lee's airline uniform for that of a law enforcement officer, you know, they're kind of like have. Interesting airline uniforms or whatever.
They don't want to they don't want to trigger him.
Right. He changed into civilian clothes for the task.
I kind of get that, like, you know, like a pilot's uniform looks like maybe he could be like, what is it, military police? MP? Is that what it's called?
Yeah. MP, yeah. Or just some sort of law enforcement officer or something.
Yeah.
In
the 70s, police used to wear those hats, didn't they?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
So the passengers remained seated. A ground crew attached the mobile staircase, and per Cooper's directive, Mucklow exited the aircraft through the front door, retrieved the ransom money, and when Mucklow returned, she carried the money bag past the seated passengers to Cooper, seated in the last row. Cooper then agreed to release the passengers, and as the passengers debarked, should be disembarked, I guess, or whatever, they got off the plane, debarked.
What happened to Schaffner? They just switched the responsibilities.
She's still up in the cockpit taking notes.
What's her name? Mucklow? Mucklow.
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 Tina.
Okay.
Tina Mucklow.
Okay.
And Florence Schaffner is up in the cockpit.
Okay. Yeah, all up in that cockpit.
That's what I was going to say, where she belongs with the last name Schaffner.
Okay. Got it.
All right. We can do it. Yep. Cooper inspected the money in an attempt to break the tension. Mucklow jokingly asked Cooper if she could have some of the money. Cooper readily agreed, handed Mucklow a packet of bills, but she immediately turned the money away and explained accepting gratuities was against company policy. It's kind of like a joke, right?
Wow. Way to be a cog. Mucklow. What's her
Mucklow
name?
Mucklow said Cooper had tried to tip her. What right. Whose name? Cog?
No, I said way to be a cog.
Yeah, like, just like a
cog in the machine.
Right.
Just like,
you know, she could get fired for accepting ransom money. Come on.
Who cares? I'd take $800 for pain and suffering.
Exactly. Nobody would see that money. I'd be like, right. Mucklow said that Cooper had tried to tip her and the other two flight attendants earlier in the flight with money from his own pocket, but they too had declined, citing the company policy.
Okay.
Bunch of narcs.
What? Anyway. Narcs.
No wonder Cooper wanted to get off this plane. He's like, oh, these squares. Anyway. Squares. With the passengers safely off the plane, only Cooper and the six crew members remained aboard Flight 305. In accordance with Cooper's demands, Mucklow made three trips outside the aircraft to retrieve the parachutes and brought them to Cooper in the rear of the plane. While Mucklow brought aboard the parachutes, Schaffner asked Cooper if she could retrieve her purse, stored in a compartment behind his seat. Cooper agreed and told Schaffner, I won't bite you.
Ew.
As in like, go get your purse, gal.
Yeah, I don't bite.
Flight attendant Alice Hancock, oh my god, then asked Cooper if the flight... I know. What? How many phallic names can all these flight attendants have?
So true.
She asked Cooper if the flight attendants could leave, to which Cooper replied, whatever you girls would like.
Ew.
So Hancock and Schaffner got out of there. They just jumped off the plane. When Mucklow brought the final parachute to Cooper, she gave him printed instructions for using the parachutes, but Cooper said he didn't need them.
The parachutes.
Parachutes.
He didn't need them. So this was he's stalling?
Or he's like, you know, I already know how to do this somehow, so it's just another piece of the puzzle.
Okay.
A problem with the refueling process caused a delay, so a second truck and then a third fuel truck were brought to the aircraft to complete the refueling. During the delay, Mucklow said Cooper complained the money was delivered in a cloth bag instead of a knapsack.
What is
it? As he had directed.
A knapsack is a backpack?
Backpack, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you gotta think it's 1970s. Bring me the knapsack, dear.
That's not how people talk.
In the 70s, yeah.
Bring me the knapsack, dude. What'd you say?
I said, dear.
Oh. I thought you said
dude. The dude was better. Like, that quote, bring me the knapsack, dude. That sounds like some crazy man you just met, like, under the freeway. That's a nice knapsack, dude.
Oh, bring me the knapsack, dude. Hey, that's yeah. Like a surfer man. Surfer man? What?
Surfer man, dude. But anyway, as he had directed, you know, they didn't bring him a knapsack. And okay. He now had to improvise a new way to transport the money. Using a pocket knife, Cooper cut the canopy from one of the reserve parachutes and stuffed some of the money into the empty parachute bag. An FAA official requested a face-to-face meeting with Cooper aboard the aircraft, but Cooper denied the request. Cooper became impatient, saying, this shouldn't take so long, and let's get the show on the road. Cooper then gave the cockpit crew his flight plan and directives. A southeast course towards Mexico City at the minimum airspeed possible without stalling aircraft. So he wanted to go really slow at a maximum 10,000 foot altitude. So he wanted to fly low and slow
all the way to
Mexico. Bars.
Like low and slow, like a crock pot?
Yeah.
Like a pot roast. He wanted to go at pot roast speeds.
He did. And they did.
I have a question. So he's right now his first demand was the money and then the parachutes, but he said, I don't need them.
No, he said parachutes, but she brought him instructions on how to use them. And he said, no, I don't need those.
Oh.
The instructions.
Oh, I misunderstood that.
Insinuating that he already knows how to use a parachute.
Okay. So then he's going to Mexico. That's
his next plan. He also specified that the landing gear must remain deployed and the wing flaps must be lowered 15 degrees and the cabin must remain unpressurized. So he's got a bunch of instructions. Yeah, he knows planes and mechanical knowledge and how things work is what it seems.
Right. Okay.
First Officer William J. Radizak informed Cooper that on the flight configuration Cooper had specified, limited the aircraft's range to just about 1,000 miles, which to Mexico City, I think there was, it's like, I don't know if that's from
Seattle. True.
From Seattle, it says that they would need to do a second refueling before entering Mexico. So Cooper and the crew discussed options and agreed on Reno Tahoe International Airport as the refueling stop.
Yeah, it's 10 hours and 40 minutes.
Yeah, so they had to come up with like a place to stop, basically.
Okay.
So basically now they're flying from Seattle to Reno, Tahoe.
Okay.
Cooper further directed the aircraft to take off with the rear exit door open and its air stair extended. Northwest's home office objected, leaving the aft staircase deployed during takeoff was unsafe. Cooper countered and said that the procedure was safe, saying, "It can be done, so do it." But Cooper did not argue the point and said he would lower the staircase once they were airborne. Cooper demanded Mucklow remained on board to assist with the operation of lowering the air stair.
Hmm.
At around 7:40 p.m., Flight 305 took off with only Cooper, Mucklow, Captain Scott, and First Officer Radizak, and the flight engineer, Harold E. Anderson, aboard the aircraft. So there's only five of them plus Cooper.
Okay.
Five of them, including Cooper.
Okay.
Two F-106.
Bomb just to get people to listen to him? Why? What's the point of the bomb?
I don't know. They wanted people to be okay, I guess.
No, I mean, why did he bring the bomb on? Was it just as a threat to get them to give in to his demands?
Yeah. Well, he's holding them hostage.
He just wants to go on vacation and he can't afford it? What's it like? What?
I don't know. Or he just wanted $200,000 and...
Maybe. You
know, and to fly to Mexico.
A convoluted way to do it. I don't understand.
Yeah. I don't understand how they just didn't come on and like... Well, I guess because he had a bomb, there's the danger of like, if they come on and try to forcibly remove him from the plane, then he'll just blow everyone up.
Right. But then, like, that's what I'm saying. Like, why not just rob a bank at that point? If you're willing to make a bomb and break the law, so many laws in so many ways, why not just rob a bank?
Well, I don't want to give away the conclusion of this, but maybe okay. Because it's a good way to do it anyway. Two F-106 fighters from McCord Air Force Base and a Lockheed T-33 trainer diverted from an unrelated Air National Guard mission followed the 747 after it had been taken off. So all three jets maintained an S flight pattern to stay behind the slow-moving 727 and out of Cooper's view. So they were just like circling the plane, keeping an eye on things. Just okay. To make sure he didn't, like, I don't know, do anything mean. After takeoff, Cooper told Mucklow to lower the aft staircase. Mucklow told Cooper and the flight crew that she feared being sucked out of the aircraft.
Same.
Valid fear. The flight crew suggested Mucklow come to the cockpit and retrieve an emergency rope, which she could tie herself to a seat. Cooper rejected the suggestion, stating he did not want Mucklow going up front or the flight crew coming back to the cabin. Mucklow continued to express her fear to Cooper and asked him to cut some cord from one of the parachutes to create a safety line for her. Cooper then told Mucklow he would do it himself and instructed Mucklow to go to the cockpit, close the curtain partition separating first class and coach, and not to return to check on him.
What is happening?
So, okay. He was like, if you're going to help me, you need to open this staircase. And she's like, I'm too afraid. So he finally was like, you know what? I'll do everything. Just leave.
But the plane is moving.
Yeah, they're in the air. They're approximately flying like 115 miles per hour. And like they're 10,000 feet above the ground. Like they're like slowly flying, but not okay. Stalling. Okay. Before she left, Mucklow begged Cooper, please, please take the bomb with you. Cooper responded he would either disarm the bomb or take it with him. As Mucklow walked to the cockpit and turned to close the curtain partition, she saw Cooper standing in the aisle, tying what appeared to be the money bag around his waist. From the moment of takeoff to when Mucklow entered the cockpit, it was only 4 to 5 minutes had elapsed. For the rest of the flight to Reno, Mucklow remained in the cockpit. Mucklow was the last person to see the hijacker. She was the last person to see D.B. Cooper.
Hmm.
At around 8 p.m., a cockpit warning light flashed, indicating that the aft staircase had been activated, so he's lowering the staircase. Okay. The pilot used the cabin intercom to ask Cooper if he needed assistance, but Cooper's last message was a one-word reply, no.
Hmm.
Suddenly, the crew's ears popped. The cabin air pressure had dropped because the aft door was open. At approximately 8:13 p.m., so 13 minutes later, the aircraft's tail section suddenly pitched forward, forcing the pilots to trim, which means to lift, and return the aircraft to level flight, so like the plane bounced. In his interview with the FBI, co-pilot Bill Radizak said the sudden upward pitch occurred while the flight was near the suburbs of north of Portland.
Okay. So they didn't make it very far.
No. Like, this was like 13 minutes into like the flight. Like, they took off at like, where was it?
So why did he jump? Why did he jump instead of making it to Mexico if he wanted to go to Mexico?
I think that's the point. He just wanted them to fly in a direction.
Okay.
And according to everyone that thought that they were going to fly to Reno. And so, you know, if they have to make a stop, then that allows the FBI to coordinate like a plan to like take over the plane or something. I don't know.
Right.
With the aft cabin door open and the staircase deployed, the flight crew remained in the cockpit, but now we're unsure if Cooper were still aboard. Okay. Mucklow used the cabin intercom to inform Cooper that they were approaching Reno and he needed to raise the stairs so that the plane could land safely. Mucklow repeated her requests as the pilots made the final approach to land, but neither Mucklow nor the flight crew received a reply from the hijacker, almost seeming like he wasn't there.
Reno as in Nevada?
Reno, Tahoe, Reno, I guess. I don't know. I don't know where Reno is.
Maybe California.
Probably somewhere between Seattle and the way down to Mexico City.
There's no way he jumped off in Portland and then suddenly he's in Vegas. So I'm dumb. It's fine. I think it's Washington or California.
Could be. At 11. What are you quacking, huh?
No, I just went Washington or California.
California, Washington. At 11:02 p.m., at the aft staircase still deployed, the Flight 305 landed at Reno Tahoe International Airport. FBI agents, state troopers, sheriff's deputies, and Reno police established a perimeter around the aircraft, but fearing the hijacker and the bomb were still aboard, they did not approach the plane. Captain Scott searched the cabin, confirmed Cooper was no longer aboard, and after a 30-minute search, an FBI bomb squad declared the cabin safe.
Hmm. So he took the bomb with him?
Pretty much. Weird. That we know of. I mean, they didn't find it, so either he threw it out or took it with him, something.
Okay.
And that's kind of like the whole rundown of the story. We're going to get into the investigation as well. Okay. But interesting fun fact, due to multiple copycat hijackings in 1972, which this happened in 71, the FAA required that the exterior of all Boeing 727 aircraft be fitted with a spring-loaded device, later dubbed the Cooper Vane, that prevents the lowering of the aft air stair during flight, which is just like the rear... like platform that lowers in the back of the plane.
That's so interesting. Okay.
See the drive. There's a GIF. I think it's under C, and that's kind of gives you an idea. It should play like it's a GIF.
Okay.
It should give you an idea of how Cooper jumped out of the plane.
Oh, okay. So it was the base. I love they showed the little guy. Oh
my God. Yeah. And so that's why the plane like lurched back and forth.
Because of the
weight displacement as well as the air. So whenever he was at the end, his weight pushed like the aft stair was in the air, right? And whenever he jumped off, his weight was removed and the air pressure slammed the aft staircase up against the back of the tail.
Oh, okay.
So that's why they probably felt whenever he jumped off.
Wow, how fucking big was he?
I don't know.
To displace the weight. Yeah,
that's the crazy thing. No one knows.
Cooper was 500 pounds.
Yes, he was pushing 8 bills. And he rolled off the back of the plane. Which is also why he needed 5 parachutes or whatever.
Right.
Why
he needed 5 parachutes.
Yeah. So here's the investigation. In addition to 66 latent fingerprints aboard the airliner, FBI agents recovered Cooper's black clip-on tie, his tie clip, which goes in the middle of your tie, and 2 of the 4 parachutes, one of which had been opened and had 2 shroud lines cut from the canopy. So there's like what he fashioned the bag out of. FBI agents, huh?
This was found?
On the plane. So he only used like 1 parachute.
Did he land? Was this over land?
We don't know where he is.
No, I mean, just like
this when, was in the plane
when he jumped. No, I'm saying when he jumped out of the plane, would they over? They were over land.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, they could have been over a lake or something. I don't know. Well, there's no ocean.
If they were over water,
there's no ocean between Seattle and Reno.
I know.
So but, it had to have been that.
But they would make, if it was over water, it would make sense that he's, you can't find him. Whatever. Go ahead.
Well, okay. It was also at night or in the evening. So, but we'll get into that.
Okay.
FBI agents interviewed eyewitnesses in Portland, Seattle, and Reno and developed a series of composite sketches. I don't know why they interviewed people in Reno or Portland, because, I mean, well, Portland, he was there, but Reno, he wasn't, so I don't know. Due to the number of variables and parameters, precisely defining the area to search was difficult. The jet's airspeed estimates, or the airspeed estimates varied, and the environmental conditions along the flight path varied with the aircraft's location and altitude. So, like, they didn't know what the wind was. They didn't know if he's flying through clouds. They didn't know.
Right.
And only Cooper knew how long he stayed in free fall before pulling his ripcord, which, you know, if you're in free fall, you're going to fall faster and get to your destination sooner. And if you're pulling your ripcord really high, then you'll float for a long time. So only Cooper knows that. The Air Force F-106 pilots, which you would think had seen something, they claimed to neither see anyone jumping from the airliner, nor did their radar detect a deployable deployed parachute. So they didn't even see a parachute. Moreover, a black-clad individual, which he was wearing all black and brown, jumping in the moonless night would have been difficult to see, especially given the limited visibility, cloud cover, and lack of ground lighting over where he jumped out.
Oh, so it was night.
It was nighttime. So, like, by the time he jumped at, like, 8 o'clock, between 8 and 9 o'clock, so it would have been.
That's eerie. I don't like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
The T-33 pilots did not make visual contact with the 727, so they stayed back far enough in order to tail the aircraft, but they didn't. They weren't looking at it.
Okay.
On December 6th, 1971, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover approved the use of an Air Force SR-71 Blackbird to retrace and photograph Flight 305's flight path and to locate the items Cooper carried with him during his jump, i.e. he had a parachute, he had to carry the briefcase and the money. The SR-71 made 5 flights to retrace Flight 305's route, but due to poor visibility, the photography attempts were unsuccessful. Which, you know what an SR-71 Blackbird is, right? So an SR-71 Blackbird flies very, very high in the sky and was used as like a stealth aircraft because you can't hear it as well as its reflective coating. You couldn't see it like flying over you.
I don't like that.
So it's more like a spy aircraft or like one of the things that the U.S. military has that's like scary and kills people.
Yeah.
During an experimental recreation of the flight, flying the same aircraft used in the hijacking, in the same flight configuration, FBI agents pushed a 200-pound sled out of the open air stair and were able to reproduce the upward motion of the tail section and the brief change in cabin pressure that was described by the flight crew at 8:13 p.m. Mm-hmm. So remember their ears popped and stuff? They were able to recreate that. The initial extrapolations placed Cooper's landing zone within an area on the southernmost reach of Mount St. Helens, a few miles southeast of Ariel, Washington, near Lake Merwin, an artificial lake formed by a dam on the Lewis River. Search efforts focused on Clark and Cowlitz's counties, encompassing the terrain immediately south and north, respectively, of the Lewis River and southwest of Washington. So, Mount St. Helens area, they were able to, like, define a search area. FBI agents and sheriff's deputies searched large areas of the heavily wooded terrain on foot and by helicopter. Door-to-door searches of local farmhouses were also carried out. Other search parties ran patrol boats along Lake Merwin and Yale Lake, the reservoir immediately to its east. Neither Cooper nor any of the equipment he presumably carried was found.
Ugh.
So, seemingly without a trace.
Right. I will never understand how people can just
can do that. I don't just, really get it either.
They just vanish.
Using fixed-wing aircraft and helicopters from the Oregon Army National Guard, the FBI coordinated an aerial search along the entire flight path from Seattle to Reno. Although numerous broken treetops and several pieces of plastic and other objects resembling parachute canopies were sighted in investigation, nothing relevant to the hijacking was found.
Okay.
So they're just always coming up with, like,
right, nothing. They're just coming up empty. Okay.
Shortly after the spring thaw in early 1972, so after all the snow has melted and, you know, it's starting to warm up, teams of FBI agents, aided by some 200 soldiers from Fort Lewis, along with United States Air Force personnel, National Guardsmen, and civilian volunteers, conducted another thorough ground search of Clark and Cowlitz's counties for 18 days in March, and then another 18 days in April. Electronic Explorations Company, a marine salvage firm, used a submarine to search the 200-foot depths of Lake Merwin. So we literally leaving no stone unturned, looking for a body, looking for evidence. Yep.
Be that deep? That's fucking.
They threw a submarine in the lake trying to find this guy.
What?
But they didn't find anything. Two local women who were civilian volunteers stumbled upon a skeleton in an abandoned structure in Clark County. Okay. It was later identified as the remains of Barbara Ann Derry, a teenaged girl who had been abducted and murdered several weeks before by a serial killer, later convicted in 1979, who is Warren Leslie Forrest.
Three names.
Fun fact about Warren Leslie Forrest is that one of his victims, and you can notice that this area is kind of the same, one of his victims that he allegedly had murdered was actually attributed to Ted Bundy. Ted
Bundy. Wow. Yep.
So he was on the... They both were kind of, I guess, captured or arrested at the same time. And they were like, did Forrest kill him or did Bundy kill this lady? So,
Warren Leslie Forrest?
Yeah, he killed, like, I think, either one to six or more victims.
Wow. Okay. I'll have to look into him.
Ultimately, the extensive search and recovery operation uncovered no significant material evidence related to the hijacking. But we did find evidence to convict a serial killer. So, you know what? A win's a win, but not a win for DB Cooper.
Right.
Based on early computer projections produced for the FBI, Cooper's drop zone was first estimated to be between Ariel Dam in the north and the town of Battleground, Washington, to the south.
Battleground. Cool name.
Yep. In 2019, so we're going to jump a little forward, the FBI released a report indicating that about 3 hours after Cooper jumped, a burglary was reported at a small grocery store near Hyson, Washington, in an unincorporated community located within the calculated drop zone that Northwest Airlines presented to the FBI. The burglar was noted by the FBI to have only taken survival items such as beef jerky, gloves, and other camping essentials.
Okay.
Now we're wondering, you know, the bills were specifically serialized and recorded. What happened to the ransom money? Because, you know, if he broke into the store, it seems like he didn't spend the money anywhere in the flight path. But were we ever able to find any of the money?
No.
A month after the hijacking, the FBI distributed lists of the ransom serial numbers to financial institutions, casinos, racetracks, and other businesses that routinely conducted large cash transactions, and to law enforcement agencies around the world trying to find this stolen cash.
How long?
Ransom cash.
Hijacking?
Huh? A month. A month after they released all the serials.
That seems like they waited too long to me.
Yeah. Well, a lot of these places probably keep books. So if people were going to look for the money, they could just look in the records, I imagine.
Okay.
Especially like financial institutions like banks, man, you know, law enforcement agencies, all that stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
Northwest Orient, which was the airline, offered a reward of 15% of the recovered money to a maximum of $25,000. So they were like, if you find it, then we'll give you some of it.
Okay.
bring it to us. In early 1972, U.S. Attorney General John N. Mitchell released the serial numbers to the general public. So finally, after a while, they released it to everyone. Mm-hmm. Two men used counterfeit $20 bills printed with Cooper serial numbers to swindle $30,000 from a Newsweek reporter named Carl Fleming in the exchange for an interview with a man they falsely claimed as the hijacker.
Oh, Carl.
So he got scammed. In early
I said, damn it, Carl.
Damn it, Carl. In early 1973, with the ransom money still missing, the Oregon Journal republished the serial numbers and offered $1,000 to the first person to turn in a ransom bill to the newspaper or any FBI field office. In Seattle, the Post Intelligencer, which is, I guess, it's a weird name for a newspaper, but they made a similar offer with a $5,000 reward. The offers remained in effect until Thanksgiving 1974, and though several near matches were reported, no genuine bills were found. In 1975, Northwest Orient's insurer, Global Indemnity Company, complied with an order from the Minnesota Supreme Court and paid the airline's $180,000 claim on the ransom money.
Okay.
So basically, no one ever found the money.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, here's some maybe reasons why. Some investigators have speculated that the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens could have obliterated any remaining physical clues that would have been, you know, easily recovered to this day.
Okay.
But, you know, because it erupted, if there was any, like a, you know, a briefcase full of cash or his body somewhere, it probably would have killed or, you know, destroyed it if it was anywhere close to the eruption.
Interesting. Okay.
The investigation basically was suspended on July 8th, 2006 or 2016. Citing the need to focus investigative resources and manpower on issues of higher and more urgent priority. Basically saying, we're done looking into this.
Giving up.
There's no way. Local field offices would continue to accept any legitimate physical evidence related specifically to the parachutes or the ransom money that may emerge in the future. So they're not saying don't bring it in if you found something. And the entire 66-volume case file, which was compiled over the 45-year course of the investigation, will be preserved for historical purposes at the FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C., and on the FBI website. So all of the evidence is open to the public, and this
I've never heard of this.
Of D.B. Cooper?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Name is very familiar, but maybe that's just because you said it to me last week.
Yeah, I might have mentioned it to you and said, I think I told you I want to do it at some point, and I'm doing it now.
You just asked me if we had covered it, and I said no, and then you were like, "Don't look into it. Don't Google."
I was gonna say, hopefully we haven't covered it because I didn't necessarily go through the episode backlog.
No, we don't. We haven't. But luckily I don't, I have the memory of a goldfish. So when you did tell me, I completely forgot. So maybe that's why when you said the name, I was like, that's familiar.
No worries. But this is the last line. And I think it's crazy. This crime remains the only unsolved case of air piracy in commercial aviation history. So no one else has ever hijacked something and got away with it.
Holy shit. Well, he didn't really get away with it.
I mean, he's like an aerial Jack Sparrow at this point.
For what?
Just the whole time over the intercom, he's just playing the Pirates of the Caribbean soundtrack. Like, da, 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 da,
da. Amazing soundtrack, by the way. Those movies fucking slap.
And the first couple ones do. Whenever they started grasping for straws in like the fourth and fifth, I was out.
I just love Orlando Bloom.
Yeah, he's cool.
And Keira Knightley and her teeth.
And her teeth.
Yeah. Have you ever seen that? Oh, it's a TikTok about her tooth acting. They said Keira Knightley attended the Academy of Tooth Acting.
She's got a famous mouth, much like Jim Carrey.
Yeah. Much like John Wayne Bobbitt.
I think he's famous for something else.
Franken penis.
Yes.
Not Frankenweenie.
Frankenweenie.
Right.
Honestly, a crazy movie to make. Frankenweenie? Like, who was like, you know what? Frankenstein's got a wiener dog.
This may come as a shock to you, but it was Tim Burton.
Oh, that's weird. I need to watch that.
He's fucking freaky, man.
I think it warrants a watch. Girlfriends, go watch Frank and Weenie and see how weird it is.
I think it's supposed to be good. I don't know.
You think so?
Well, his movies always do well.
Right. And it's an animated movie. It's not like him trying to go for like an Oscar or anything. So.
I think it's based on Pet Sematary, the Stephen King book. Or if it's not based on it, it's very reminiscent of it. But basically,
maybe it has
a bunch of pets come back to life or something. Something like that. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Okay. So that's all I got. That's my case.
Wow.
I mean, my mystery, whatever, same thing.
Very thorough. Well done.
Sorry for the long one, but I mean, I do think it's kind of interesting.
I had a short one, so it worked out. It would have been like a fucking 3-hour episode if I did my normal length.
That's true.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, girlfriends, let me know what you think about the case.
Tell us what you think about episode 55. I would love to know your thoughts on the Bobbitts and D.B. Cooper.
Yeah, and if you have any other ideas, I think I got this one from Molly, or I can't remember exactly who requested this, but let me know. Let me know if you got any other mysteries.
And all this episode has just been full of dicks, right?
Full of dicks. So
full of dicks, full of cocks.
Go clench your palate after this.
I said clench. Go clench your palate.
Go clench your palate.
Cool friends, follow us on Instagram where murder meets mystery, and email us where, Trevor?
Where murder meets mystery @gmail.com.
That's right. And Dad. Guys.
Call your dad. Get your paps. You know how it is.
Call your paps. Get your paps. We are so happy that you joined us today. And hey, if you're new here, give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Spotify.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll see you next week, I guess.
Yeah. Fucking mic drop on this one, buddy.
Thanks. Good jobs all around there. Yeah. You're pats on the back.
Good jobs all around. Okay, girlfriends, we love you.
Love you, girlfriends. Good game. See you later.
Good game. Bye.
Adios.